Welcome, everybody. My name is John Campbell. I'm a developer with SharePoint at Microsoft. My co-presenter today is Jonathan Kern. He's also a developer with Microsoft. We both work on the SharePoint team. This is the Building Apps with SharePoint 2013 UX platform. So before we start, some basic logistics for the session. We're going to try and talk for about an hour, maybe less, maybe more. Hopefully, we'll have about 15 minutes for a Q&A, or maybe if you're lucky, we'll get you guys out of here early. Feedback channels, we love feedback. You can use hashtag SBC028, hashtag SBC12. I'm at Microsoft underscore John Camp, no H. Be careful with that. And then this is Microsoft underscore J Kern. We, of course, want you guys to fill out the session evaluations. And please, you're welcome to find us after the talk. We'll be at the Ask the Experts tomorrow. And raucous applause is definitely appreciated, so feel free to woohoo and such throughout the presentation. All right, you guys are listening, that's great. So what we're going to cover today, first thing is a really brief list view history. How many of you have done customizations for list views in the past? All right, yeah, you're in the right place, that's cool. I'm super excited about that. Okay, we're going to go over client-side rendering. This is a new rendering technology for SharePoint 2013. We're going to cover callouts, the developer preview for callouts. We're going to briefly touch on the client-side object model and how it relates to the new CSR platform. We'll talk a little bit about the new animation platform we have in SharePoint and how that also fits into client-side rendering and what you can do with that. And, of course, everybody's favorite, demos, 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 and more demos. So, a brief history about list views. How many of you used SharePoint 2007? Had to do camel-based views. I am so sorry. All right, so on the upper right, hopefully you guys can see that or have blocked it out of your memory by now. That's the camel rendering pattern that you would have used to do a custom view in SharePoint 2007. So you had a render pattern. There was some sort of HTML block. You could output some markup in these CData blocks, and then you had this column sub column number zero business. It really didn't make much sense. I mean, certainly it was good enough at the time, and it was a breakthrough at the time, but we needed to move forward. So in the SharePoint 2010 release, we adopted the schema-agnostic XSL-based rendering model that you guys have been using so far. And so if you've messed with XSL, this should look pretty familiar. You've got an XSL template, you give it a name, you give it a match, which is basically a rule for how you want it to be applied, and then you say, what do you want it to do? There's some state there with that XSL param to get some information about where you are in the DOM tree. You output a span, and then a bold tag, and then there's this crazy XSL value of select dollar sign this node gobbledygook. I will admit, even though I worked on this product, it took me a really long time to fully understand what that was actually doing. So if you're still struggling with it, don't worry about it. So today, I'm happy to say that we are able to embrace HTML and JavaScript and CSS for the rendering patterns that you're going to be able to use in SharePoint 2013. So again, the top right is going to be what you did in SharePoint 2010, and the bottom right is the equivalent of what you'd end up doing in SharePoint 2013. And the reality is that actually writing the 2013 code makes you understand the 2010 code a lot better. Because all that was really happening out of that dollar sign this node business is what you see in the lower right. We were doing basically go to the context, get the current item, and then within that item, go and find the current field, and then find the value, and then just output it. And so that's what we do in the SharePoint 2013 CSR world. All right. Great. And so let's dig a little bit deeper into what the client-side rendering actually is. So the great thing about CSR is that we were able to take the great things that we built on in the XSL world and bring them forward without the actual XSL. So the reality is that the problem is still the same. We need a schema-agnostic view. You want to be able to change the fields but still render using mostly the same information across the board. So whenever we render a view, whether it was in Office 14 or Office 15, we use list data, the actual rows that come back from the database. You've got list schema, what's the information about the fields you're actually rendering in a given view. You add that in with a rendering template, and you end up with HTML markup on the outside of that. So in 2010 release, We executed that via XSL on the server, and then the server would send down rendered HTML that would then get interpreted by the browser and displayed. In the Office 15, so the SharePoint 2013 world, sorry, I'm going to be interchangeable on that. You just have to live with it. In the 2013 world, CSR executes on the client. So what we send down is we send down basically a JSON object, which is the data, a JSON object, which is the schema, and we send down either straight up JavaScript for the templates, or we send down a reference to say, hey, please go download this JS file. And then we execute those templates on the data at the given time. And this gives us huge advantages of all the AJAX goodness that you would expect from a modern web application. And then once we've rendered that HTML, we've generated that markup, then we insert it into the DOM via inner HTML and similar techniques. So CSR templates come in two main forms, JavaScript functions and strings, or that end up being basically micro templates. So we'll start on the left-hand side, which is the function base. This is probably for the developer audience, is probably the most comfortable and familiar to you. It's very simple. You've got a function, you give it a name, and then it takes in an argument. The argument is the context. The context is an object that we had before in SharePoint 2010, but it was mostly used behind the scenes. It becomes much more prevalent in the CSR world. The context is essentially the truth about the view. It has all the information you need. It's got the data, the schema. It's got information about what's the base view ID, what's the list template type, what control mode you're in. We'll talk about that stuff later. But needless to say, you can consider it to be the truth about the state of where you're at right now. So we take in that object, and then from there, your function can do basically whatever you want. It's JavaScript, so if you want to use jQuery, Node.js, Knockout, whatever you want, whatever makes sense for you, given the scenario that you're trying to implement. In this case, we're going to create a string variable, we're going to assign some markup to it, and then we're going to get some values out of this context. So we're going to use the context, go address into it like you would any other JavaScript object, and then we can come down and we can say, if true, then do whatever, or you could have whatever conditional formatting or conditional statement you want there, and then we output more data. And then what you end up returning out of most of the standard templates is a string. And so that's the mapping between the XSL world and the CSR world, is you're still really dealing with HTML string-based generation. We do have a method to do DOM manipulation. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So on the right-hand side, you see the string-based equivalent to that function on the left. So the string equivalent is more akin to what you'd see in jQuery templating or maybe PHP data binds, those sorts of things. So you've got a string. And inside it, you add some markup. And then we've got this angle bracket pound and then the equal sign and then the angle bracket pound. So as with other sort of escaping methodologies, this ends up getting compiled into essentially the function on the left when you actually run it. But what you're actually doing is you're saying angle bracket pound equals says, I want you to execute this JavaScript code and please take the resulting value and put it into the output string. If you say angle bracket pound, then you're saying, please execute this JavaScript code, but I don't want you to have the output to be put into the output string. And if you look at the example, it makes a lot of sense. You've got up here, we're taking a value, and we're going to output that into the output stream. Down here, for the if statement, we don't want to actually put that into the output stream, but of course, the value down below, we would. And so either way, when we have the output, you see it down below. The result is still the same. So the render context. As I said, the render context is the truth about the view at the moment that you're rendering. It's an object which is created and sent down from the server, and it's got a variety of information. Some of it's SharePoint properties that you might need for rendering, and some of it's just general state information. So you've got the list data. That's the JSON object that contains the data that came down from the server. So you're going to have your ID 1, your title for your list item, things like that. Your list schema is going to be the schema for all the fields. Control mode is going to be if you're on a form, you can have display or edit or new, for example. Base view ID, does anybody just know what base view ID is? Okay, you all do? So yeah, so the base view ID is basically you can have lots of different view types. And you have base view ID 1 is all items, for example. Base view ID 0 is the summary view on the home page. Or you can have base view whatever number you feel like. And so that's a way of having multiple views on a list at a given time. So we pass that down so you can use that. There's a list template type. List template type refers to your specific list's template type. So, like, I think 101 is the document library, 100 is announcements list, something like that. And then on pre-render and on post-render. So these functions are essentially, they come down as a part of the templates, and these are your opportunity to do manipulations to either the data or the DOM, respectively. So on pre-render, the idea is that if you want to mess with the data in some way, shape, or form before we've ever even started string generation, then that's your opportunity to do that. And we'll show that in the demo, and I think it'll make a little bit more sense then. On post-render is your opportunity after the string has been generated and after it's been inserted into the DOM, that's your opportunity to do more DOM-based manipulation. So we're really giving you the choice. If you want to do it at string generation time, if that makes sense for you, great. If you want to do it at DOM manipulation time because you want to do more event hookups and you want to use more fancy jQuery stuff, great, you can do that too. So it's really up to you and your business case for what makes sense. And oftentimes you may find that you'll end up doing a mix depending on what parts of the view you're overriding. And we'll show all of those in the demos. And then, of course, templates. The templates is a structure that includes all the information for saying, well, I want to override an item, or the head, or the body, the footer, that sort of thing. And we'll see a little bit more about that in just a second. So the template set. So as I noted, there's a hierarchy. So this hierarchy, for those of you who come from the XSL world, should be very familiar because it maps one-to-one with what we had before. So we've got a view that's sort of the overall container. We've got the header. The header, generally speaking, is going to contain the drop-down controls for sorting and filtering, that sort of thing. You've got a body, and you've got a footer. Within the body, you've got a group. The grouping sometimes is a pass-through. It basically renders nothing and just says, hey, render each item. Or if you have grouping turned on, then it adds extra functionality. You've got the item level, which is effectively one row from your SharePoint list. And then you've got individual fields within that row. And this template set, by default, will execute in this hierarchical fashion. And the grouping may end up being there or not, depending on what your actually view is configured like. So that's great. We ship it out of the box. It works. And almost all the features that you're going to see by default in SharePoint are built on top of this client-side rendering. So we took a big bet. We put our money where our mouth was and said, we need to use this to build our stuff. So you can rest assured that we've used it and it works, and we've been building on it the whole release. So how do you make your own modifications? Well, at the end of the day, this is HTML and JavaScript. So what you need to be able to do is get JavaScript onto the page. So we provide a few convenient ways to do that. So the first way is you can insert plain JavaScript. There's some .js properties on a few of the common places. And again, if you're familiar with the XSL world, pretty much anywhere where you would have found the XSL property, you're likely to find a JS property that will do a similar thing. Okay? And in the same sense, anywhere where you would have found a XSL link property, you now find a JS link property. The JS link property is there for you to say, hey, in the case of the XSLT list view web part, for this particular instance of a list view, I want you to download this extra code, which will contain my overrides. SPView.js link, that would be for the view object. So every time that view is instantiated, I want you to include that file. And then for the SP field, it's the same thing. Every time my field is included in a view, which happens to be client-side rendered, I want you to download that file. And so a good example of the field is like the geolocation field. It wants to do mapping and other sorts of things. So it has a JS link set that says, please download my mapping JavaScript. And there's a few other places where you can find JS link properties that I know Wes is over there. Say hi, Wes. Wes is going to be talking tomorrow about some stuff, so he'll probably mention some JS link stuff. And also, Kirk Evans has a talk right before. Same room. So check out their two talks for a little more information on some of the other stuff that we just don't have time to cover today. So the overrides. Overrides are pretty straightforward. The process is fairly simple. You're going to take your template. You're going to create a context object which says these are the overrides I want to do. You're going to specify your overrides in there, and they take two forms, either templates or these on pre-render, on post-render functions. You're going to specify a scope. And the scope, remember in the XSL world, you executed in isolation. So every time you rendered a view, each view executed in isolation because it was on the server. These execute in the global context of the JavaScript and the browser, so the scope is much, much more important. But the idea is still the same, because in the XSL world, you could share templates, you had rules that you use. Same idea here. You can map to the control mode, the base view ID, the list template type. After you've done all that, you've constructed your object, then you're going to make a call to spclienttemplates.templateManager.registerTemplateOverrides, and you're going to pass in that override context that you've created. In terms of the templates that we ship out of the box, there's two main sets of templates that you're going to find. One is the SP client templates, and the other is SP client forms. So client templates really means the views that you see, so a regular list views type of thing. Client forms, our forms technology is actually using client-side rendering as well, so you actually can do client-side commits in many situations. We also have a hybrid mode. We're not going to talk about that in this talk. But needless to say, we will show some overrides via CSR for forms as well. There's also the SP client renderer. The SP client renderer, technically speaking, is a generic thing. It's not necessarily tied to SharePoint. And it allows you to do the client-side rendering. As long as your templates and your data and your schema match, that's the important thing. So if you're using SharePoint data, then you should use SP client templates, and then everybody's happy. If you have your own data, you need to make your own templates and make sure that your schema matches accordingly. And at the end of the day, what ends up happening is we call spclientrenderer.render. It's a very simple function. It says, where do you want to put this stuff, and what is the context you want me to execute on? And it'll go and take that context, it'll grab the templates, grab the data, and the schema, it'll munge it all up, do your on-pre-render, generate your HTML, run your on-post-render, and then it'll put that all into the place that you indicate. So with that, enough talk, let's go to demos. All right. Can we see that okay? Yeah. Is that cut off? A little bit? All right. Let's fix that a little. Okay. So the scenario that we're dealing with today, I'm going to put on the hat of a real estate agent. Feel free to throw tomatoes, et cetera, at me as a result. The idea is pretty simple. So I've got a list of houses that I have for sale that I'm keeping track of. They've got a title. There's got a photo that we haven't filled in yet. There's an ID that maps back to the multiple listing service. You've got an address, city, state, zip, so the actual address of the home. There's a list price, and there's a listing date. And so what we want to do is we want to modify this view. So let's take a look at the code real quick. By the way, if you guys didn't go to the Visual Studio session this morning, we're building on top of that. The tools are great, and that's what we're going to be using the whole time. Very, very simple deployment. We're running on a live Office 365 dev tenancy right now. So to show you the schema is very straightforward for this list. Those are the fields that we described. And then here is our view. So we've got base view ID 1. And then here's the XSL link that you would recognize from the past. So the new thing is the JS link. The JS link is going to be where you're going to specify your overrides. So by default, you almost always want to include clienttemplates.js. Clienttemplates.js includes all the SP client templates that we discussed earlier. Specifically, those are the ones that you need for rendering a typical view. Now, you can use the pipe character, and then you can add on your other templates accordingly. These could live in, say, underscore layouts, but certainly if you're on O365 like we are now, you need to store them somewhere else. So these are actually living in a document library that is deployed as a part of this solution. So we can use tilde site, whack scripts, whack listings.js is my JS file. And I also have applied that same JS file to two of the forms, the display form and the edit form. So with that, let's go to the code. Code's very straightforward. And again, do that, great. The code's not doing much. There's some goo at the bottom that helps work with script on demand to make sure that if you're dealing with MDS, that things work fine. Otherwise, it doesn't really do anything. Let's make it actually do something. So I actually highly recommend that you do this as your first step as a part of doing your overrides, which is make sure it actually works, because the first problem that you have if you're dealing with CSR is my code actually running? Okay, so we're just going to refresh. Hooray, listings.js. So we know it's working. That's great. So now we actually have a basis that we can go off of and start actually adding our code. So we'll go ahead and comment that back out. And we'll add our first override context. All right. So here's the basic override that we need to do. So we have a function called listing overrides. We have a context that we generate, and in that we have it's an object. In there, we instantiate a templates object. Okay. The next thing is these two lines here. These two lines refer to the rules that we're using to limit when this override is applied. So in this particular case, base UID 1, I only want to apply it to all items.aspx based on the schema XML we saw earlier. If I had another view that was base UID 5, then I'd have base UID 5 here. And then the list template type 10,000, that's the template type that was specified as a part of the list deployment, and you can go find that as well. So then we've got a template for fields, but we don't have anything there yet. We've got an on pre-render that we've commented out, and there's no on post-render. And then as we noted, we've got SP client templates, template manager, register template overrides, and then there's the context. And then these two lines down here, these have to do with making sure that the code actually gets executed properly. So this executes it on first load, and then this is here to make sure that it gets loaded properly if you're doing MDS transitions. Great. So let's go and try that again. So we're there. We'll refresh. And great, we have the exact same thing. But that's a good thing. So one, we're not alerting anymore. But it makes sense. We haven't actually done anything with our override, but it has been registered. So that's a good thing. So let's move forward. Let's actually do something with it. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to do a basic field-level override. So as I mentioned, you can override in many ways. It's sort of up to you. So the first one we're going to do is we're going to override the field template for that main photo field. The main photo field happens to be a URL field. And what we're going to do is we're going to say, great, if it's pointing to a picture, it'll show it. But if it doesn't have a picture, by default, it shows nothing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a placeholder image there at first, and then we'll modify it even more in a little bit. So we'll uncomment out that code, and we'll do SPC field level override. And so here's the code. So for field level overrides, you take in a context, and it happens to also take in a reference to the field object, to the list item that you're working with, and the list schema object as a whole. We do a little bit of work to grab the data out of the field, but the great thing is this is actual JavaScript that any of us can understand, unlike that XSL gobbledygook that we were dealing with before. And then, note, I'm calling a function. You can reuse code very, very easily because it's just JavaScript. You can do what you want to do. And my render image function, very straightforward. I'm going to create an array, and because we're going to use it kind of like a string builder. I'm going to say, well, if there's no URL, then I'm going to set the URL to be this generic image and have a description. And then we'll just go through, we'll generate our markup, and then we'll do this ret.join, which basically says, take that array and munge it together into a single string. Okay, so let's save it. And we'll refresh. Hooray! Great, that was super easy. So now we're able to customize that field. And the great thing is that that's super simple, but that's the basis of the conditional formatting. If you want to do red light, green light, you know, sorts of things, that's exactly what you need to do, is a very similar thing. If you want to, say, replace team names with images of team names or whatever else, that's the idea. So that was doing it based on markup. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to go and we're going to use the on pre-render and the on post-render. Okay? So as I noted, on pre-render has to do with manipulating the data or the schema or whatever other things you might need to do before you actually generate your strings. And then on post-render is after that happens. So I'm going to add an on pre-render that is listings hide fields, and I'm going to do an on post-render that is listings restore fields. So in the view, I've got this address, city, state, and zip. I want that data, but I don't necessarily want to show it right now. So one way that you could do it is remove it from the schema temporarily, because that's what we use to decide what we're going to render. So we'll go ahead and add that code. And it's, again, pretty straightforward. The pre-render and the post-render take in a render context. And I'm just going to say, well, go get the list schema. And I've got a function which will go through and hide each of those fields that I want hidden. And all they really do is move them from one array to the other array. And in restore fields, after the view is rendered, then I'm going to just put them back in the context schema object just to, you know, as housekeeping sort of stuff. So let's save that. And control F5. Great. And it goes away. So that's super easy. But let's do something a little bit more interesting. So the number one thing, when I've talked to people, and especially coming from the SharePoint designer background, everybody wants to do conditional formatting on a row as well. So well, let's do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, OK, I'm going to add a highlight row override function. Now, you note that I, on this onPostRender, I actually have an array of onPostRenders. So you can have many onPostRender, many onPreRenders, and you can add them as you need to, depending on your circumstances. So I'm going to add a second onPostRender. And let's go and let's add the code. And this code is pretty straightforward. It's great. It fits on one screen. So the idea is very simple. We're going to go get today's date. We're going to go calculate the milliseconds in a day. And then we're going to go through each row. And in the row, we're going to go and get the list item. And we're going to figure out from the list item, what is the listing date? Now, you may have noticed in the schema that I had this listing date. And I have this listing date internal. So I'm using a calculated field because the one that we render, it goes through the processing to have localized and all that sort of stuff. But when I want to do the calculations, of course, I want to do it on something standard. So I use the ISO 8601 version. So using this calculated field, I'm able to keep those in sync and have one around that I want to be able to use. So I'm going to use the ISO 8601 version that I created. I'm going to turn it into a date, the listing date. I'm going to do some simple math right here. And all that really does is it's just going to figure out how many days has this item, this house been listed on the market. And we're going to say, well, if it's been more than 90 days, that's a bad thing. We need to somehow adjust things. And then in order to actually do the highlighting, remember, we have DOM objects now. We're not at HTML generation time. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to use this helper function, generate IID for the list item. So basically find the ID for the row that I care about, and then go get that row. And then we're just going to do very simple. As long as we have a row, we know that we want to highlight it. So we're just going to set the background color to be a 50% transparent red. All right, so let's go ahead and try that. Ta-da! And honestly, the greatest thing about this is sort of twofold. So the first thing is that it's regular JavaScript that was super easy to write, so that's good for you because you'll be more productive. But the other thing is every college student in the world knows JavaScript. Shoot, there's 6-year-olds out there, 3-year-olds that know JavaScript. So this really, it really empowers more people to be able to do meaningful overrides that are maintainable and understandable, much more so than the XSL. So I think it's a really, really big win. All right, so the last thing I want to show, I'm not going to dive too deep into the code, but I did mention that we can do forms as well. So let's do that now. All right, so I mentioned that we had the rules for overriding. So on the original one, we had base view ID 1, which is the view, and template type 1,000 or 10,000. Okay, so down here, you can actually have more than one override registered at a time. You can have hundreds if you want to, in theory. And the basic idea is that the engine will do it the best it can to try and figure out what is the right override for you right now, given your state. So in this case, I'm registering a second override, and we'll actually register a third in just a minute. So this override basically says, well, for list template type 10,000, I don't want to specify the base view ID because this is actually for forms. I'm going to override the fields. And so for the attachments field for this view, I want to override on the display form. I've got my attachments field for the display form. And I've got a similar one for the edit form. And the code's a whole lot of code. This one happens to be a copy and paste mostly of the attachments JavaScript from clienttemplates.js and the clientforms.js. And again, for those of you who are familiar with the XSL timeframe, essentially when you did an override, this is exactly what we did. We took the existing template, we made a copy, we added some special stuff to give it a unique name, and then we allowed you to sort of mess around with it. And then now you're responsible for making sure that if we, for some reason, ended up changing the template, you have to make sure yours gets updated. So really, this is exactly the same as what you're used to, but it's better because it's JavaScript, so you can actually understand it. Okay? So let's go ahead and save this. Control S. And let's go ahead and run it. Control F5. All right, great. So notice nothing's different on the form or on the view because we didn't touch the view. So let's go to the form. So here's the display form. So normally speaking, on the attachments field, you'd see a list of attachments. But now you can see we've got these little thumbnails of the pictures. Awesome. That was pretty easy. Now let's go to the edit form. So one of the really common tasks that I've been asked about is how do you make this work with forms? And it's JavaScript, so you can manipulate it however you want to. So one of the things I'm going to do is I added these right here. So when I click it, you notice that main photo actually filled in. And so you can see the power of this. If you want to have sliders, go get jQuery, jQuery UI. You want to drop a slider in, boom, go for it, done. As long as you wire it up to the right fields that are that the form's expecting, you're good to go. All I did here is I said on click, go find the field for the URL and dump that value in. You can also do sort of the choose your combo thing where you say, like, what salad do you want, what main dish, what dessert. You know, you can fill down that way. Again, it's just JavaScript. So every sample you'd find on the internet with a little tweaking is just going to work. All right. And as you see, when we save it, now you can see that we've got this photo here. It propagated through. So that actually added a lot of value because now we've got an easy way for us to actually assign that URL field rather than having to figure out how to do browsing, whatever else. All right, so let's go back to the slides for just a minute. And so we're going to talk about the next thing, callouts. Callouts is a developer preview. We want your feedback, okay? We are using it internally, of course. You saw it in all the demos for the document library and everything else. But we certainly want to know how you guys want to use it, so please let us know. So callouts are fairly straightforward. They're essentially a bubble with a beak, as we called it internally. But basically, they're a dialogue with an arrow pointing to a launch point. A launch point is just a DOM element. There are three main ways to use a callout. You can use it essentially as an empty dialogue where you're responsible for putting whatever content you want to in there. You can use a list-based callout, which is basically you can override in a way that we'll show in just a minute, and you'll get the same look and feel that you saw in the keynote demos, for example. And then you can use the helper methods. And the great thing about the helper methods is that you get the same look and feel as you get with a list, for example, but not on a list, or on a list, but not using the standard override that you'll see. So a basic callout, as I noted, it's a bubble with a beak, and there's a launch point. And then there's a close point, a close button if you want to have it. And then inside, there's a div, and you put your stuff there. And then for the list-based callout, or if you're using the helper methods, it looks a little bit more like this. So we've got a header, we've got a body, we've got a footer. Inside the footer, there are typically actions, callout actions. They're basically just glorified links, but there's a nice API that allows you to say, hey, I want to add an action. Here's the is it enabled, here's the is it visible, and here's the on click, and you're good to go. And the main thing that really gives you is the visual look and feel, so you don't have to worry about the CSS. We take care of all that stuff for you. We make you look great. I'm trying. All right, so again, so let's hop back to the demo. All right. So we've got a bunch of code here. Let's add a little bit more. C underscore callout, not callout actions, callout override. There we go. All right. So as I noted, we can do lots of overrides in the same file if you want. Now certainly you could split these up if you want to, and that really has to do more with a performance question. And if you have performance questions, you should go to Sterling's talk tomorrow. It's going to be great. And you'll just have to choose between Sterling's talk and I think Wes's talk. But maybe you'll just do both. Either way, So we've got another override function here. We got the same context object that we described earlier. We specify templates. And for the base view ID for callouts, we use a special callout base view ID in order to hook it up. But we want to use the same list template type because you might have more than one view on the page, so you want to make sure that you specify for this type of list, here's the callout override that I want. And then from here, we'll show you can override the item template. So we've got a function here. And then for the footer, we're using, again, a little bit of JavaScript magic that makes it work really great. We've got a function that's anonymous that takes in the one parameter, which is the render context. But then we're going to say, hey, there's a generic callout footer template that we provide for you. So you probably want to use that. But when you pass it in, you give it a render context. And then you've got this thing called the actions menu populator, which allows you to insert your own actions into the list instead of using our ones out of the box. And then you can say, hey, do I want you to show the ECB in the callout or not? Again, it's up to you. And then we can do the same register template overrides. And we'll look at the code real quick. So the render item template looks very similar. This is HTML generation time. We go and get the current item. We say, hey, this is the field I care about. We're going to go get the URL and the description. We're going to use that same render image function that we used earlier. So again, now we're using code sharing. That's always a good thing. And then we're going to use the work address, city, state, and zip, and we're going to output that. Because remember, the data's still there. We just hid it from the view before. And that's the kind of the idea with the callouts is that you want to say, well, use a high-level overview in the list view, but then use that detailed information in the actual callout. And it's up to you whether or not you want to say, bring down that data beforehand and just use it like this, or do you want to say, go call a web service, either use CSOM or use some other web service to get additional data and then fill it in that way. So it's really up to you and what your business case is. For the actions menu populator, the basic idea is you get the render context, so you can address that if you need it. And then we've got this call it action menu object, and you say, hey, I want to add an action. And in my case, I've got a relist action, and it's got an on click, that's this relist action. And then we're just going to store some state on the objects, because remember, it's JavaScript, so you can store state where you need to. And of course, you can use whatever best practices you feel is appropriate. And the relist action is a great opportunity to show that, hey, we can use CSOM here. So we're going to get the call out. We're going to figure out, hey, from the call out, get the context that we care about. We're going to grab today, and we're going to turn that into an ISO 8601 string. And we're going to call this function update value and list item. And when we do that, we're going to use CSOM. Most of you have probably seen that from the current release. We're going to grab the list, get the list item. We're going to set the value, and we're going to call update. And then we're going to execute that query. And depending on whether or not we want to update the value in place or not, we'll either reload the page or we're going to refresh the list view without reloading the page. And Jonathan Kern will show that in just a minute. So great, we've walked through that. Let's see it run. So we'll refresh. And look at that. There's my custom callout. So it looks the same as, very similar to what the ones that you saw in like the keynote, but it's got my own custom picture, it's got the address for the house, and it's got this nifty relist action. So it wouldn't do anything up here because this house is a pretty new listing, but let's look at this one down here. We'll go relist, and we'll continue, and let it go. Demo fail. And that should have relisted it. So, all right. In any event, so that's that. And so with that, then we'll go back to the slides real quick. So we're halfway there. So now it's time to turn over to Jonathan Kern.
All right. So so far we've seen how to do customizations on UI that's already there. For example, the little ECB menu John turned into a callout. For the photo field, we added a placeholder photo. What I'm going to dive into now is a little bit more custom. Maybe you want to add a callout somewhere where there normally wouldn't be one. So straight into a demo. Who needs slides? So we're back to our demo. And what I'm going to do here is add a callout over here to our photo column. Right now, it's just a photo. It's not super useful. So we'll go back to Visual Studio here. And first thing we'll do is add one more on post render. So let's fill in the code way down at the bottom. And what's a demo without a little bit of hello world? So we've got our add photo callout method. We're using script on demand here to make sure this doesn't run until callout.js has been loaded. Most of the time, this is kind of already there, but this just makes sure that our code is safe from any timing bugs. So we're going to go through every single list item in our list, get a reference to the item. Just like John showed before, we're going to get the IID for the list item and use that to get element by ID. So conveniently, our photo field, we've set an ID on it earlier when we made it, so we can get that element directly and store it in photo element. So right here, I'm going to have some content. Right now, just hello world. And we'll start building a callout. So for a typical callout, you need to create a callout options object. This is just a simple JavaScript object, and it's got some interesting properties. First off, we've got a launch point. This is where we're going to launch the callout from. We'll give it a unique ID, a title, the content, again, just using kind of the JavaScript string builder trick. Beak orientation, so in this case, we want our callout to appear either to the left or to the right, depending on where there's space. We could also make it open to the top or bottom. Then we're going to take that object, pass it out to the callout manager, which will create a new callout, and we're going to store some extra state on the callout object so that when the callout's open later, we don't have to go index into some global to find data. It's just stored on the callout itself. So I've got that code. I'll go ahead and save. Cool thing about Visual Studio here is Control-S just saves the JavaScript right back up to Office 365. There's no redeployment. It's just all seamless. It's pretty awesome. So refresh. Wait for it to load. And I can click this. And we've got Hello World. So that was easy. Let's do something a little more useful with this callout, though. Yeah, applause. I'll take it. So Hello World's kind of boring. Let's replace this with something more interesting. Get rid of that. SPC. Notice a trend in our snippet naming. So here's a same sort of approach, building some HTML. I've got a div that's our photo row with some styles on it. I've got an image element that'll store a photo. And I close the div. So now we need to have some code that will grab all those attachments that John showed earlier and stick them into this callout so that we can make a little photo rotator, because that would be pretty cool. So I'm first off going to uncomment our onOpening callback property here. And we're going to say that when we're about to open the callback, let's call into this other method to do some processing ahead of time. And here's our code. So first off, we've got a global. As we showed before, you can store state on the object itself. Another way to do this is to just have a global and track it that way. We just wanted to show either one, but do what you're going to do. Here's our method that's called when the callout's opening. It gets past the callout object, so we can keep track of that. In this case, we're going to store it in that global. And then we're going to call a function called getAttachments. So we'll get some information, store it in this for further reference. We've got the callout object. We've got the list of attachments we're going to store on the object just for easy reference, and the index in that list of what we're currently showing. We're going to use some good old CSOM to get a client context, index into the list, and get the list item. And we want to load up all the attachment files on the list item. So we'll do an execute query async. Just like normal CSOM, we've got a failure. Usually that just prints an error. In this case, we've also got our success, and that's much more interesting. So on success, we now actually have our attachment files. We want to enumerate through those attachment files and store them into our attachments list. And we just do that here with a while loop. And we'll store that back on the callout object. Now we can get it easily. So now we want to show this in some interesting way. So we're going to use the getContentElement method on the callout. This is going to give us a reference to the div element in the callout that has all the content in it. And we can then use Query Selector on that to get all our relevant UI, in this case the photo row, the photo itself, and we'll handle some cases. So of course, if there's no attachments, we want to keep track that there is no index showing, hide our photo element, because we don't want a little spinny thing going on there. Otherwise, we want to say we're pointing at the first attachment and make our photo element point at that attachment. And the last thing here is we're going to refresh the actions, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. So, let's see. Now we want to go ahead and add some actions on this callout. So like John pointed out, you can put kind of any links you want into a callout, but you can also use our helper methods to put links on the bottom that look just like the rest of SharePoint and gives you some useful tricks for enabling, disabling, showing, and hiding. So that's what I'm going to do now. So we'll do this one. Oops, wrong place. Almost. After call manager. There we go. So we've created our callout here. We have the callout itself. So after we've created the callout is when we're going to go ahead and toss the actions on it. There we go. So just like in John's demo, we're going to call an add action and create three different actions on our callout. First off, we've got previous and next so that we can go through our photo rotator. And we've got a default button that will set the photo that's currently showing as the default photo for the listing. Each of these has a on-click callback and an is-enabled callback. So I'm going to go ahead and stick some stubs in so that that's all working. Right now, these are pretty straightforward, just some empty methods. But let's fill in the enabled ones. So I'll start off with the bottom one just for convenience. This is the callback that we'll call to make sure whether the default button is enabled or not. And there's some pretty simple things we want to check for. We want to make sure there's no animations pending, which we'll talk about a little later. We want to make sure that there are attachments in the first place, and that there are attachments in the first place. And then for our nav buttons, we want the same set of things. So we're calling into our default callback down here. And we want to make sure, for example, on the previous button, that if we're showing the first image, obviously we don't want to let the user go previous again. And similarly for next, we want to make sure the user can't go next further than the end of the list. That's pretty straightforward. I'm going to save. And refresh. And hopefully we'll have a better looking callout. I'll open it up. Great. We've got a photo rotator now. But so far, we haven't actually plugged in our next and previous buttons. They just kind of show up. We do see that they're disabled appropriately, but they don't do anything yet. So let's make that happen. So I've got my empty nav click one. Gonna put in something a little more fleshed out. So this is the function that gets called whether you click previous or next, and we pass it a direction. So first thing we'll do is grab the callout contents again, grab all the UI elements from it, and then do the navigation. So for previous, of course, we're decrementing the index we're showing. We're updating the source of the photo. For next, similar thing, just going the other direction. And finally, we want to refresh those actions because the enable-disable state may have changed based on how you've navigated. So we'll save that. Refresh. Cool, so this works. That wasn't very much code. So moving on, there's another button that we haven't really attended to yet. That's the default button. So let's add some helpful code to do that. So this is the method that gets called when you hit the default button. First thing we're going to do is look at that global, make sure it's filled with the appropriate callout object. We're going to use that object to get back our context, get back the item that the callout's on, get the content element one more time, get the photo within it, and we're going to look at the source of the photo element. Now, this is really cool. it's HTML JavaScript. We have the photo element, the image. We know what its source is, so now we know what image is being shown. There's no need to keep extra state that's hidden from the user. Just use DOM as the truth. We'll use an SP filled URL value, basically plumb this down into SharePoint list data. And I'm going to call that same update value and list item method that John showed before that will update the list item. Now, what's really interesting that you should pay attention to is this true. So as John showed earlier, we can make this update and refresh the page and do a round trip to the server, get the new list data, and re-render the list. But in this case, it's a pretty easy change. We know what's going on. We're changing the URL of a field. So instead of doing that round trip, we can just play with the data in memory in JavaScript and then tell the renderer to just re-render using that new data. So I'll save, and you can see what that looks like. So I'm going to pick this second one so that you can see it's currently the little blue empty one. And we've got some images. It works as expected. So I'm going to pick this image. Done. There was no refresh. We never went back to the server. Now, behind the scenes, of course, there was a CSOM call. We did update the list data. And if I refresh, you'll see that that main photo is still selected. But there's no reason to cause the refresh for the user. They just can see without the page refresh, the contents has changed. So this is pretty functional. It does what we wanted it to do, but you know, let's make it look a little prettier. So we're going to go in and do a little bit of code replacement. So I've got this function that runs when I click the navigation buttons. But I want to make that look a little prettier, so I'm going to put in a different one. And I'll talk through this code. So far, it's pretty similar. We're getting the callout contents element. We're getting some elements within it. But now we want to do some animation. So SharePoint 2013 has a great animations platform built in. There's lots of great information about that is or is going to be on MSDN. And I'll have some more information at the end. But let's walk through. We've got our photo element. And it's currently statically positioned on the page. But for animation, we need it to essentially be lifted off the page, so to speak. We need to position it absolutely so that we can move it around freely without affecting contents around it. So there is a great method that's there for you to do so, call position absolute on the element, and that's going to lift it off the page. Then we can call another helper method to get the left offset of the image. So this is going to tell us exactly where on the page it is, and we can use that later. We're going to set its opacity to be 1, just to be very explicit that it starts at fully opaque. And then we're going to kind of get ready the next photo that we're about to navigate in. So we'll just clone that element. Again, this is just DOM. I'm passing false here to do a shallow copy because it's just an image element. There's no children. And for the new one, we're going to set its opacity to 0 because we want to start it completely transparent. So depending on the direction you're going, in, for example, for previous, we'll do the same decrement on our index. We'll set the new photo source to point at the previous photo. And we're going to set its left position, in this case, to be just before the current photo. Then we're going to insert it in the DOM before that photo. For next, it's kind of the same, just the opposite. We're incrementing. We're setting the source. We're putting it just we're putting its left position just after the current photo, and we're appending it to the DOM. So finally, we'll set an animations pending field here. This is just for a little housekeeping. We'll refresh our actions. If you'll remember before in our enable-disable methods, we checked this animation pending field. So by setting it to true here and then refreshing the actions, we're essentially just disabling our nav buttons while animations are occurring. We're going to set some IDs on the elements because animation works with IDs. And without IDs, it can get a little funky. So we want to make sure that both of these elements have well-known IDs. So then we get onto the animation itself. And there are 3 steps to do an animation. The first step is to describe the final state, where you want the element to be and how you want it to look at the very end. So to do so, we'll create a new spanimation.state object. This is to animate in the new photo. And we'll set some final state attributes. So we want, at the end of the animation, for the new photo to be fully opaque. And we want it to be positioned at the same left position as the current photo. So essentially, it'll fade and slide in. For the current photo, all we want to do is make it fade to nothing, kind of as the new photo slides on top of it. So we've created our two final states. Now we go on to step two of animation, which is creating the animation objects. So first we'll talk about animating the new photo in. We'll go parameter by parameter. The first one is the ID of the animation we want to run. Now, out of the box, SharePoint ships with a bunch of animations in a catalog. And we've got simple ones from a basic move, basic fade, and we've got more complex ones like this one, which will do a slide in and fade in. What's really cool is that these animations are not just typical linear animations. They can be run to a curve, which will make them look and feel motion-wise like the rest of SharePoint. So you can use our animations platform, and your animations will look like they were built with the product by the same engineers. We've got our delay. Just want to make this animation go immediately. Of course, you could make several animations happen in some sequence. We're going to tell it we want to animate the new photo, give it the final state we produced above. And then we have a function to run when the animation's finished. So in this case, I'm going to do a few things. First off, I'm going to reset the position of that new photo. So remember, before we lifted the photo off the page, now we're going to put it right back onto the page. We've animated it into place, and so to the user, this won't look like anything. There won't be any visual change, but it will now be statically positioned again. We're going to set our animations pending to be false because we're no longer animating, and refresh those actions so that our nav buttons become enabled again. And to get rid of the current photo, we'll do a basic fade. Start that immediately. We're animating on the current photo with the current photo final state. And when this animation is done, we just want to remove it from the DOM. Finally, we have our third step, which is to run the animations. When you call run animation, we're taking those objects and handing them off to a shared timer across the page. And the shared timer will deal with running the animations at the appropriate speed. And so it's all asynchronous. You don't have to think about it. And that's why we have those after the animation's done functions. So I'll save. And go ahead and refresh. And we can see what this looks like. So launch my call out. Hit next. Ooh. That's what I like to hear. So running back to slides, I've got some related sessions to talk about. But first, quick recap. Today we showed you how to use the client-side rendering framework in SharePoint. We've showed you how to kind of override existing UI as well as add new UI during the overrides, both before we render and after we render. We've shown a little bit of CSOM, which you may be familiar with, and you can definitely learn more about. We showed you callouts, which is a developer preview. We're really excited to get your feedback, so please let us know via Twitter or any other methods. And we showed you animations. So some related sessions. There's client-side rendering in SharePoint Server 2013. That's Kirk's talk. That's tomorrow. Fun with SharePoint Social, CSOM, and Windows 8. And finally, customizing the way SharePoint 2013 looks. That's tomorrow night. I'm doing that talk along with my coworker Lionel. And that's going to show you how you can do customizations like this and integrate them with the look and feel of SharePoint. So with that, we'll go to Q&A. There's microphones on either side. It's kind of a big room. It's kind of hard to hear otherwise. So we'd appreciate it if you go to the mics.
Quick question for
Thank you.
Back in the past, when you render a calendar, for instance, the DOM will not update right away, but it will take some time. And we used to have to use some special functions in order to update items within a calendar, because at the time you were trying to run JavaScript, it won't actually update. There were some hacks around, you know, to get that done. I don't know, because you actually touch the DOM as well, so I'm not sure that by the time you're trying to do that, you know, how do you ensure? Right now we saw a list. What about a calendar?
So I think the answer for a calendar is basically it's always sort of been a special case, and so basically that's something we should talk about, like ask the experts and kind of deep dive into more so because it has such a special way of rendering and so much interactivity. Naturally, with the interactivity, there can be some issues that creep up, but I'm happy to try and deep dive with that at the ask the expert session. Other questions?
Could you share the code?
The code? Yes, we will figure out some way to share the code, one way or the other, whatever that means. Yes.
How much time you spend for that JavaScript?
For this JavaScript, actually not that much time. It was generally not that much time. And honestly, the biggest issue for me was that I spent so much time building the infrastructure that I hadn't done as much time actually using my infrastructure to test it. So it was really relearning the stuff that I implemented, you know, months and months and months ago that I'd been gone off and done other stuff. But as far as this actual code, it took me about a day, maybe 2 days of writing it, and a third of that was actually just figuring out what the right development tools were. Once I actually found the Visual Studio 2012 and got it working and got the dev tenancy working, I mean, it was cake. And that's the great thing, is you saw the rapid iteration. Granted, you know, we were pasting in snippets, but as far as like the typing and stuff, it's not that dissimilar. So yeah, about 2 days. And I know Jonathan spent about a day maybe or so maybe on his animation stuff.
And I will say, I'm not the developer who wrote animations. She couldn't be here for the conference. So I learned all of this in the last couple of weeks and put together this code. It's pretty straightforward to learn, especially with the documentation available.
Right. Yeah. Other questions? No, you can just yell.
Okay. We'll repeat.
So you have this wonderful store now where you can sell apps.
Yes.
And in the old days, we used to make web parts, which we could sort of pass them off to each other.
Right.
You don't have a good solution to take these things and make them commoditized so people could, like, you know, a la WordPress, install a plugin that automatically adds these things.
I'd beg to differ. What we did today was an app.
Yeah, it is an app.
So this was a SharePoint hosted app.
This is a straightaway app. So
that app would do the entire list and all the other stuff.
Right. Well, so it depends. It basically depends on what you want to choose to package, right? So in this particular case, we were packaging a list template along with some JavaScript files that go along with that template. But you could easily componentize this into, I have an app that is just the JavaScript files, and then I have other apps which have dependencies on that app, which end up saying, okay, if I'm using that other app, that's where I get my JavaScript files from, and then I'm going to have list instances in my own app, which sit other across. So it's more of how creative can you be in order to design the solution that you need, more than it is a limitation. As far as, like, can I go download a announcements list template and just sort of use that straight away, we might have to figure out what the right solution is for that. But as far as, like, certainly custom list templates and getting the associated JavaScript, that's exactly what we showed here. And by the way, this is a SharePoint-hosted solution. You don't have to have any Azure or anything like that. So this is by far the most portable of the solutions, though you certainly could incorporate it in with an auto-hosted or a provider-hosted scenario as well. Other questions? No. So I think, Wes, were you talking about those a little bit, or was Kirk? Web parts? Yeah. So there is the new web parts. I saw it during the apps talk earlier. So there's a way to do a client web part. And then as far as the server web parts, those are still around as well. At the end of the day, it more has to do with what's the right model for you as a developer. If you're hosting on O365, it's a secure solution, right? So we're not going to necessarily allow you to run your C# code on our servers. But if you're in a provider-hosted scenario, go for it. If you're in an auto-hosted scenario, go for it. So it's really more about giving you the right choice for your scenario to fit what your needs are. Other questions? No? Okay. So if you have another... Oh, yeah. It's up to you. So you can put them in the master pages directory. There's actually some content types that go along with override files. I think one of the either Wes or Kirk are talking about that, one of the two. In this particular case, there's a scripts directory that comes by default with a SharePoint 2013 app. And so we just put the JavaScript in there. And as you saw, we did the tilde site, whack scripts, whack whatever. And that works out great. You, in theory, might be able to host it on another place. It's just a matter of the security model relating to that, so that I'll sort of leave you to investigate that for based on what your particular scenario is.
In your example, that means that JavaScript file will be executed for all the other leads as well, as long as you match the template ID and the base ID?
No. So remember, we have the JSLink file, so the JSLink property. The JSLink property has to point to the JSLink file that you want executed, because it's not going to be executed automatically. It's only going to be executed on pages where you have views where that JSLink file has been specified. So only where you've got a list view of template type 10,000 that happens to have that JSLink because you're base UID 1 or because you're a form, then it will go and grab that file. Now, Once you're on that page, then yes, the code executes globally. And so that's why we have to do the scoping. You may want to do other namespacing type things, you know, good JavaScript hygiene. We left that out mainly for clarity in this demonstration, but certainly you should use all your good JavaScript coding practices in that regard. And that's probably the biggest difference between XSL and JavaScript, is that the XSL executed in isolation and this executes more globally in the browser. But I think we've addressed the critical pain points in that regard.
Over here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we overwrote that.
Mm-hmm.
We made our view look exactly the way we wanted it.
Great.
But we put all the JS in the master page download and deployed the whole thing as a traditional solution.
Sure.
Didn't make it part of the app.
That's totally fine.
That's totally fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
I just didn't show it here because I hadn't even used the Visual Studio tools until about 2 weeks ago. And when I found it, I was like, wow, this is great. So why wouldn't I want to show them? I didn't realize there was a whole talk on the Visual Studio tool, so now it's redundant. But it seemed cool at the time.
Yeah,
either approach works. And again, as we said the whole talk, it's all about your choice, what makes the best fit for you. For some people, Master Page Gallery is the right choice because it's a more global sort of thing. For some people, it's more of an app thing, so you keep it in the app directory, in the scripts directory with that app. It's just up to you.
In that project, we also overwrote
forms. Sure. Great, that's awesome. I'm happy to hear that. Right, absolutely. Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm definitely happy to hear that. And that's exactly what we're hoping for is, you know, using drag and drop animation, whatever you want to do, whatever, you know, processing.js or, you know, jQuery, whatever you want to do, you can do all those things because at the end of the day, all we really care about is did you stuff the right values into the right hidden fields behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Right, you're probably using on post renders probably.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a choice. And as I noted, basically it's for your given scenario. Are you most comfortable with HTML generation, string generation, or are you most comfortable with DOM manipulation? And the reason I chose the specific demo that I did is because for fields, there's no templates below them, so they're very atomic. And so certainly in a demo situation like this, it's very easy to say, I want to do exactly what I want to do, that's it, no muss, no fuss. In the case of, say, overriding the item template on a traditional view, you're responsible for calling any downstream template structure that we normally would have done for you. Right, and that's what you have to do. And so you don't have to use our downstream logic necessarily. You can actually manually say, I want to have this field and that field, the other field. We do that, in fact, on like the blog template, for example, and the discussion boards. And so it's up to you. You can call things directly. You can use our sort of give me what the view is giving me sort of scenario. It's whatever works. The reason I went with the on post render for the row level override is because it was the item level, there's all that extra goo that you needed to do. So it was much simpler to say, well, I like the template as is. I just want to tweak that one setting. And so the DOM manipulation was the cleanest and most straightforward way to do it. But like I said, either way works. And yeah. That is a great question. Next question. I appreciate that. I'm really happy to hear that you guys did figure it out and try it out. The best answer I can give you is that it's going to be part of the standard documentation time frame for SharePoint 2013. Yes. I'm a developer. I'm not a PM. I'm not a marketer guy. So I don't have full insight into those answers. We will certainly figure out a way to get this out there, you know, onto the interwebs via tubes and trucks and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I think there's a lot of really big untapped potential, and not that you couldn't do a lot of the stuff in the XSL timeframe. It was just way, way, way harder. And so the fact that we're doing it in pure JavaScript, there's a lot of really awesome scenarios that are out there for you guys to really show us what you can do, and really have compelling interactive views and forms and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, we use CSR all over the place.
All
the product,
over.
Like
yeah.
Search, access requests, theming, tons of places in the product where we're doing really big, powerful UIs with just CSR
yeah.
running them.
Yeah, basically everything you see and touch is almost all CSR these days, except for the specific web parts. Right, so MDS...
Tomorrow, Sterling session.
Sterling's talking about it a bit. He's Sterling. Sterling Crockett. What's SBC what? So it's SBC 142. Right. Yeah. And so any of the little subtle gobbledygook that you saw was mostly relating to MDS, and it's just making sure that if we don't do the full page transition, we do the magical super fast one, that it actually works properly there. But the great thing is that you don't really have to worry about it. You just insert a couple lines of code and make sure you follow those rules. And then for the most part, all the other code is just normal. So it's just those little tiny bits of stuff you don't have to worry about. Right. Well, that's why we're putting, that's where we're going to figure out how to put this out there and accompany it with the rest of the documentation in the appropriate time frame.
Move to a few more questions if you have one.
Sure. Right. Sure. I think it really has to do with what your particular scenario is. So if you have a very app-like thing, then you should probably put it in a app-like package. If you have a more full-on, like if you're doing your own custom master pages, it makes perfect sense that you would have custom JavaScript that would go along with those. And so that's the rule of thumb, but I imagine that there may or may not be a white paper on that later.
And I mean, if you're doing like full trust solutions for, you know, just your corporate intranet, fine, you know, go for it. Apps, of course, are just more flexible. You can use them in SPO.
Right.
You can use them on-prem.
And again, kind of nice. For this particular demo, it was nice to have that little bite-sized app model and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
All right, this is a bit of a higher level question.
Sure.
Just in general. So for folks like me, I've been doing the .NET way for a very long time.
Sure.
And so I'm going to be doing a lot of transitioning, obviously, for this new model.
I did the same transition, so that's okay. I get it.
Where's kind of the best place to go just in order to get an idea of what's the kind of the complete tool set that you need to be looking at for the new approach to developing apps with the app model as far as, like, you know, just jQuery, I mean, you know, JavaScript tool sets. There's a whole thing of...
Right.
You know, what should you be trying to get a command of?
Right. So realistically speaking, when people talk about jQuery, Node.js, Knockout, all that sort of stuff, those are all helper libraries that have great benefits for their various reasons, and they have great sub-libraries that you can use for whatever reasons, and those are all good. But the reality is that CSR is HTML, JavaScript, CSS. So that's the core in terms of what you need to know, which as a web developer, you're going to have to learn those anyway, so there's not really a huge... net addition to the stuff you need to learn. As far as the tool sets, if you want to do an app type model, which if you're just starting out, I highly recommend. Like I said, I picked this up about 2 weeks ago because I'd been writing the underlying code for so long that this was super, super simple to get started. So I would highly recommend just doing a basic SharePoint hosted app, throw in your JavaScript into the scripts directory and do it that way and kind of tweak away there. And that's really all you need to get started. Now from there, if you want to start customizing CSS and you want to get more in depth, then you just have to start figuring out, okay, well, do you want to go for like an Expression Web or a Dreamweaver to help you tweak the CSS? You can use those tools to help you start mocking up the HTML that you want, and then you can kind of copy it, paste it back into the templates, and then make the templates output that code. So that, if you're just starting out, that's another really great way is to sort of mock up what the page should look like, and then I actually print out copies of those pages and then circle them and say, okay, this is my field template, this is my item template. And once I can get those boxes, then I can start sucking out the code and dumping it into the appropriate templates.
My advice would be, you know, start small, start with, like I did, a Hello World, and just start adding pieces to it.
Right.
Over time, you're going to see, oh, well, I kind of want a slider here. Here's some library that does that for me. And you'll start to learn those things over time.
Yeah, and so, again, that's part of the reason why we showed this demo exactly how we did, is we wanted to say, here's a natural progression of literally how I developed the app is how we presented the app to you guys. It's like, okay, I've got a view. Great. Now I want to hide some stuff. Great. Now I want to make this field do something. Okay, great. Now let's make this other thing do this other thing. That's by far the best approach I can recommend. Yeah.
So the question was if we have any more chunks of UI that we didn't have time to demo.
Right.
We have a few things that are not new to 2013, but were in 2010.
Right.
For example, dialogues. So much like a callout, except for it's modal and it appears on top of the page.
Right. Gives you kind of the lightbox view, if you're familiar with that API.
Let's see. MDS is an interesting kind of side aspect to all this, and
right.
like we said, Sterling will talk about that tomorrow. That has to do with transitions between pages.
Right, we've got the ribbon, of course, the ECB. So all the stuff that you saw in the apps demo with the ECB that was actually plumbing through into the ECB that's in the callout. So you can still get those ECB items in the normal places. But yeah, so most of the stuff in 2010 is still there and still available. This is just more goodness. So with that, I think there's probably plenty of questions. If you have separate questions, I'm happy to stick around and answer whatever questions you guys have. And I appreciate your time.
Thanks.